is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet. It's another Monday night. We're going to be talking about sex addiction. I think this is a topic that's very complex. As you know, this is the Shame-Free Zone, and we definitely want to embrace positive sexuality. And a lot of my colleagues, actually, in the sex-positive movement seem to be under the impression that there is no such thing as sex addiction, because oftentimes it seems to come under the probably an enforcement of moral codes, other people's ideas about what is appropriate and inappropriate sexuality. And, of course, as you know, I very definitely embrace lots of diversity in that department. However, it's been my experience that sex addiction is a very serious issue. It may not be as prevalent as some people think. Maybe it is. That's something hopefully our guests will shed a little light on this evening. But the side effects of sex addiction, I've personally witnessed. I have fortunately been spared that particular addiction. But if somebody who's in recovery from drugs and alcohol, certainly can spot the signs of addiction. And no matter what you're addicted to, including sex, you're not having a good time. So tonight we're going to be talking to a married couple who's actually made that journey themselves and are still happily married. And hopefully you can get some pointers this evening on whether or not this affects your life, and if so, how you might be able to find a more positive reality for you and your significant other. Paldrum Collins and George Collins wrote a couple of great books. Actually, Paldrum and George co-authored a book called A Couple's Guide to Sexual Addiction. It just came out this year. And Breaking the Cycle, Free Yourself from Sex Addiction, Porn Obsession, and Shame. George co-authored that with Andrew Eidelman, I believe is how you say his name, and that came out in 2010. You guys are kind of prolific authors, aren't you?
I guess we are.
Yeah, we're doing it. My book can't. You know, was in the making, and then all of a sudden one day somebody called up and said, just a publisher, you know, it's like a dream for an author, you know, and a publisher called and said, we'd like your wife to write a book.
Okay, we got to start a club here, because I actually wrote a sex manual that came out in 2005. It was the same thing. I was just sitting here at home, and I opened up my inbox, and there was an agent wanting to sell me a book deal.
We were there to take the check.
I know, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. How many words, and when do you want it?
Yeah, and the other piece is that it is, as you mentioned, it is an area where people really do need help and support. So, you know,
you guys are very bold here. Now, Paldrum, you actually have a background as a former Buddhist nun.
Yes, and now isn't that something?
It's amazing actually, because then George is a self-confessed recovering sex addict.
Oh, all the way, yeah, all the way. I pulled out all the stops.
You know? So you guys, you kind of represent the two extremes, huh?
Yes, yeah, yin and yang.
Well, you know, one would think so in a way, but, I mean, on the other side, it's like really what you were talking about. It's like, how do we learn how to express our sexuality in the most healthy, wonderful, connected way that we can, and that's what the potential is, and that's what we're interested in supporting, and that's what we're really talking about here.
That's what we do for each other.
And that's what we do for each other, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, how did you guys meet?
We were in a workshop together, and we just happened to bump into each other, and George George started to tell me what he did for a living, and I oftentimes tell the story that I wanted to stick my fingers in my ears and go, la, 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 and run from the room. But I didn't. He's a great guy. And so I had to get over myself and, get over my, kind of uptight Midwestern ideas about, talking about sex and in mixed company. I'm using my air quotes here. And you saw him, yeah. And really start to understand and hear about the true problems that he went through and how that has impacted him sexually and impacted his ability to connect in an intimate way with a woman. So, by working through that together, and that's been really wonderful for both of us and an education for both of us.
Well, a lot of women, I think one of their worst nightmares is that they would be married to a sex addict. And I'm just wondering, you met George, and he was already out as a recovering sex addict. Is that true?
I already had my practice established, so I was in pretty good shape. But I lost two wives over this. I mean, it was not pretty. My early life was not pretty.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, George? I mean, I think the listeners might be able to relate.
Well, when I was a young kid, my parents were daffy. They were alcoholics, and my dad was a sex addict, and my mother did everything but have vaginal sex with me, everything. As a little boy. So
you were an incest survivor then?
Pardon me?
You were an incest survivor.
Yes. Yeah. At least emotional incest,
yeah.
And so that was a mess, and my father beat me senseless most of the time. Mm-hmm. And so, but I did find his porn, and I have some, the thing that I identified there was what we call euphoric recall. So I had this great recall of finding my dad's porn, and things were so bad in our house that anything like that that gave you a happy feeling or an exciting feeling was something that you wanted to nurture and cultivate. So I cultivated that instead of, being a great student or being a great athlete at the time. So it was a mess, and I...
Now, did you tend to stalk people sexually? You've got a story about the blonde and the beamer, which suggests...
Blonde and the beamer, yeah.
Yeah. Just you might
really
follow
stalking
people around.
If you talk to anybody, most of us have followed people. A woman with a low cut blouse in the market, or when you see somebody driving, you kind of wistfully look over. At the time, as it says in the story, I was just trying to find somebody to lead the way to, so they would get the speeding ticket. And so I tracked in behind this beamer that was going about 65, 70 miles an hour. And then I looked and I happened to see it was a blonde. So then I started to fantasize the way a sex addict would, instead of just looking at the horizon or enjoying the beautiful valley that I was driving through in California.
Yeah.
And started to get ideas. And the exciting part was when I pulled up alongside when she was pulling off, and I looked over and I saw it was a really ugly guy with pockmarked face, and that was a big wake up call for me.
That must have not been a real erotic moment for you.
It was just before I saw his face. Yeah, just before then it was. But right after that, not so good.
Mm.
And, that's when I started to, there was a moment of starting to wake up saying, what in the world are you doing? And one of those great moments.
Yes. How many years ago was that?
Let's see. That must have been 24, 25 years ago, down in Salinas.
So would you say
on Route 101.
Would you say that you've been sober or in recovery from sex addiction for
25 years. I'm just getting ready to get a 25-year chip this year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that.
I just got a 26-year chip in another program.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal. I hope the listeners hear that. It's very hard.
You know, whatever your addiction, there's a 12-step group for it, and they really do work.
That's right.
Yeah, I found Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and it worked. It was a good thing for me, and I just wanted to expand on it, so I went and got a master's degree and decided that I was going to make this my life's work. I teach what I most need to learn every day.
And you and Paldrum operate something called Compulsion Solutions, help for sex addiction and porn addiction.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that program?
Yes. We have what we generally do is work with people all over the world, mostly this country and Canada, and we do telephone work with people. Especially good in this situation because a lot of people are real shy about wanting to come to an office where a sex addiction therapist is. So we work, probably 80% of our people are on the phone.
Are on the telephone, Do you have clients from around the world?
We have clients from right now from Africa, from Indonesia, from a number of them from Australia. It must be the water there or something.
a lot of folks because it's down under.
People from Canada.
I see you were on the Anderson Cooper show. Anderson just got that show recently, so that must have been for the release of this latest book, huh?
Yeah. We've done a lot of radio and a lot of TV.
Yeah.
So the other thing we do is we call it an intensive, residential intensive. So people come here from all over the country, especially the people that have gotten themselves in a bit of trouble, especially with their wives. And they do a one-week intensive where they'll do two sessions a day with me or one of my staff. And then during their lunchtime, they'll go and, two or three hours, they'll go do homework. So everyone that works with us has to go through the book, and the book is all I know about how to take care of sex addiction. And it worked for me, and it's worked for hundreds of other people. If you work with us, you have homework.
That book is actually number one on Amazon under sex addiction and porn addiction.
Yes, number one. Yeah, I'm thrilled. My old mentor.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So it's exciting work. It's fun work. And you know what they say, if you do what you love, you don't work a day in your life. So it's fun for me to go to the office, and I talk to 20, 30 friends a week, and that's how it works. And Paldrum feels the same way about her clients.
Well, Paldrum, how do your clients differ, or do they?
Well, I work with the wives and the partners, so, you know, basically, these people really need support in getting one that they haven't caused their partner's problem. It's a separate issue, and because I am married to this guy who is a sex addict, I can help them not take it personally, and work through their own feelings of deficiency . And you know how can they relate to this guy in a loving way that allows him to have his problem over there, and then intimately connect and come back together and learn communication skills. So there's some relationship work that can go on that really augments the work that the guy needs to do just to get over his addictive compulsive behavior.
Well, most sex addiction, of course, is secretive and it involves a certain level of dishonesty. So when you're helping the partners of sex addicts who are presumably in recovery, how do you reestablish that trust? What are some of the signposts? I would think that a lot of partners would feel like I had no idea this was going on. I didn't know that, and then I found out, and now I feel betrayed, and I don't know how I could ever trust him again or trust her. Whatever
gender is. Whichever way it plays, yeah. Well, that's exactly right, and that's exactly what people feel. And so there's what the partner is going to have to go through is working through those feelings, and the partner who has acted out needs to do some work to reestablish the trust. And one of the basic ways that that trust can be reestablished by telling the truth in all kinds of little and big ways. And, you know, the first step that the partner needs to do is fess up. And that's oftentimes a really hard thing for the guy to do because he's ashamed because of the shame factor. So, we, you know, together we can work with helping the partner. George can help with the guy to really go ahead and speak about everything he's been doing, and I can work with the wife or their partner in how can they hear that and not take that as an affront or an assault to them, but as something that is their guy's problem and not their problem.
Because I notice you make reference to the sex addict as being in the male gender. Do you never encounter female sex addicts?
Sometimes.
Starting to come up more and more now.
With
the advent of the Internet, there's women going online, and they're originally most of the women that I talked to, and I talked to maybe 30 people a day call in. But originally it was just men calling in over their own issues, and now women are more starting to call. They get on the chat lines, and then they get pulled into meeting clandestinely with men.
Right.
And a lot of those meetings don't go well. They get beat up and kicked around and hurt. These are guys that some of them are dangerous. So then what happens? It looks like then they go into more of the fantasy stuff the way my guys are.
I recently was speaking at Sonoma State University, and they had done an in-class survey. So this wasn't statistically significant, you know. It wasn't published, but I thought it was very interesting research results, nevertheless. And that was that the class basically broke down to 99% of the men were regularly viewing online porn, and about 65% of the females were, and this is the definition, regularly viewing online porn. So there's definitely a trend for younger women to be accessing porn almost as frequently as men do. Now,
we don't have any real problem with porn as long as people don't get hooked up to it.
We're interested
in people understanding intimacy. What I didn't get because of my emotional incest was, and what most young men aren't getting is how to be intimate. We learn when we're in high school or junior high now to objectify and sexualize and just look at women's body parts and comment on those and not talk about what it's like to be, the sort of trite way of saying is it into me you see, intimacy.
Mm-hmm. So, you guys go to high? No.
Pardon me?
That's a term from the Human Awareness Institute.
Yeah.
Question then. And this is one that is posed to me by my clients oftentimes. I'm wondering what your answer might be to this. I will be asked, how do I know whether it's too much or too little porn? What's a normal amount? What's an addictive amount?
Here's the deal. When you realize, and it's hard to realize because we go into denial. I was the denial king. But when you can't stop, even when you know it's in your best interest to stop, when you feel ashamed, when you start to feel the shame sneaking up, I like to say you can't get enough of what won't satisfy you. When you realize that there are not enough breasts on the Internet and there's not enough people having sex, if you're preoccupied with sexual thoughts or your impulses or your desires, if sex is if the porn or the sex is getting in the way of having intimate connection with your wife or your partner or your boyfriend if you're a gay guy or your girlfriend if you're a gay woman, if your work is suffering, if you're not connecting and doing hobbies, that's enough.
So
that's kind of a universal definition for any addiction is if it is creating problems in your life and making your life dysfunctional, then obviously it's out of balance. I certainly could think of some just heartbreaking stories for myself of clients who have lost maybe, I remember one client lost 3 jobs in a row because he couldn't stop masturbating to porn at work. Just horribly crippling addiction.
Yeah, I had a guy. I had a guy a month ago call me. He said, "I called you a year ago, and I should have come." I said, "Well, what's going on?" He says, "I have all my belongings from my office in my car. I was making $300,000 a year, and 20 minutes ago, the police, you know, security guards came to my office and had me pack up this box, and I am no longer have that job. It is over. And I need to come see you. Do you have time?"
Wow.
And of course, I tried to make time. I mean, that's a bad situation. And there's a guy with a wife and 3 kids, 2 of them in private school.
Oh, terrible. So I guess he couldn't stop at work, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, I think where you started it at the top of the show, saying really that I'd really like to reinforce that it's not about there being anything bad about sex, there being anything bad about porn inherently, there being anything bad about masturbation inherently. It's about if you're using any of those compulsively as a bomb rather than for the enjoyment that they do bring, then it's a problem. And if it
I
is
often
a problem,
liken it to food, because, you know, food, we've got Overeaters Anonymous, and if, you know, the definition of sobriety and Overeaters Anonymous is very personal. It's something you have to work out with your sponsor.
For some people,
there are certain food groups that they might just avoid because those are triggers for them. But it's
because
not just those foods are wrong or bad, but for them personally, it becomes a slippery slope that they don't want to approach.
Yeah, they just go off the rails with that particular thing.
Yeah,
so, yeah, that's
potato chips or
about
ice cream or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And so how, you know, just could you give us an example, maybe a couple examples of what sobriety or recovery in sex addiction could look like? Are there any sexual anorexics that
we get? For sure. Yeah, I was a sexual anorectic.
What would that look like?
I think everyone is a sexual anorectic in the truest sense who does porn, because you're really not doing, you're really not connecting.
Mm.
So there's a whole lot of sexual anorexia, people that just don't do sex or people that just masturbate. And as far as I'm concerned, that's anorexia. But what sobriety looks like is wonderful, because you just don't need, if you do what I say and your way, you know, if you're a client, we have a lot of cognitive behavioral work that needs to be done. What we do is try and empower our clients by using a technique called dialogue. And so what I'm trying to do is get the client to take my job. So when clients call, when it's time to do homework, we focus on something that's troubling them specifically that week. Like, could be fear or shame or pain or self-doubt or judgment or criticism. Could just be addict. And I have them actually create a new script for themselves, a dialogue, and they send that to me. They sit down and write it during the week. And every day they do a dialogue talking to the worst thing that's troubling them. So what I'm really trying to do is get them to observe their mind. You know, part of what we do here is the Eckhart Tolle kind of thing of, you know, by realizing that they're not their mind, they're not their story, that they have a story, and most of it's all right. Tie your shoes, stop for red lights, cross at the green, eat 3 meals a day. But when it comes to sex, we have to come up with a new story for them. And so what I try to do is get them to dialogue until we get a story that we like. Because when my clients call, they have a soap opera going on. It's not an epic story. It's not a story that they want to keep. So they have fun doing it. There's a lot of resistance because mind is a worthy adversary. And the story is a worthy adversary. And the story wants to stay focused on being an addict. And nobody ever had a bad orgasm, so, you know, they like to have them.
True enough. It's a great positive reinforcement. And you said you did cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right, right.
Do you ever help your clients pair other, maybe other stimuli? Like some people have used, of course, a negative reinforcement, you know, kind of a punishment model for addictions, whether it's cigarettes or sex addiction.
No, we don't do that.
Yeah.
I had a guy that was doing the rubber band thing and snapping his wrists, and I told him to stop it.
My husband,
he wanted to put it on another body part,
smoking.
And I told him not to do that.
Well, you know, the possibility is that the sexual urge, the natural sexual urge, can be combined with the love and connectedness that you have with your partner, and when you bring those two together, then the possibility of the giving and receiving that can happen sexually is so much more than just the combining of some body parts. So it's taking what's beautiful about sex and combining it with the loving, intimate connection, and that creates something that's much greater than the sum of the two parts.
Mm. Yeah, I talk to my clients and tell them, you know, when we were kids, you and me, it doesn't matter how old I am and how old they are, but when we were kids, the other kids were talking about body parts. Nobody told us about intimacy. Nobody. I didn't even have the talk. I mean, nobody told me except the other kids what to do. And these kids were telling me to get sex. And so I did it the best I could. And I did pretty well at it, I'm afraid. And then because I was incested, I was really shot, blown out on intimacy. And so porn became just a go-to for me. It was just simple. Those were my girlfriends.
I love your headline here for the insert for your book, Breaking the Cycle. Even centerfolds have hemorrhoids.
Yeah.
You want to elaborate on that a little bit, George?
That's a little bit of aversion therapy, isn't it?
That sounds like it to me.
Yeah.
Where that came from was that I had a client who I just couldn't seem to break from the porn shop, this particular porn shop in Oakland, California. And so one day I was just getting frustrated myself because, you know, we're the kind of people that like to get things done. We don't need to keep clients a long time. We've got lots of clients. So we're trying to move them through. And this guy said, well, you know, what about next week? I said, well, I'm going to meet you at that porn shop. And he said, no. I said, I'm going to meet you at the porn shop. So I met him at the porn shop, and we walked in, and I started talking real loud, which is not something you do in a porn shop, because there's a guy up front with the tattoos and a baseball bat behind the counter who doesn't like you to talk loud. But I didn't care. So I started talking real loud, and I said, well, what are we looking for? And he said, well, my client said the bondage. And I said, where's the bondage? Real loud. And of course, by this time, men are fleeing out of the door like lemmings, you know. They're trying to get the hell out of there as fast as they can because they're embarrassed. And the guy behind the counter is getting really upset. So we get to the bondage section, and I open some of the magazines, and that's when I held one up, and I said, my God, it looks like this woman has hemorrhoids, you know. And in that moment, my client's face turned 7 shades of green, and to this day, I still get Christmas cards from him, and he has never looked at another porn magazine after that moment because I did that crazy, silly, fun intervention.
My God. Okay, well, I think that does sound like aversive therapy. Now, you guys actually talk about the difference between shame and guilt, and I loved it. I was reading this on page 103. Of a couple's guide to sexual addiction. And I've actually gotten into a few friendly discussions with colleagues who don't necessarily agree with this particular definition, but your definition and mine resonate. I do think that guilt is actually a good thing oftentimes. It helps us define what we consider to be morally right or wrong. Whereas shame is something that attacks our core, self-hating. So mm-hmm. how does shame and guilt come into play when it comes to sex addiction?
Well, you know, guilt is what we need to use is what we use to teach ourselves. So, you know, we have a constant feedback system going on where we try something and it works, and we try something else and it doesn't work. So if you do something that you see is harmful to yourself or to someone else, then that's the moment to say, I don't want to do that anymore. And that's where guilt can be useful. I don't want to create that harm anymore. I don't want to do that thing that is debilitating to me or to my partner. So that's part of the feedback system. So that's where the guilt can be incredibly useful. And I think we all have that as part of our system. But the part that comes in on top of that, as George calls it, the gift that keeps on giving, the shame, just debilitates us. And that kind of freezes us and creates a certain kind of self-hatred so that we can't use the mechanism of the guilt to create something new. Then we just start hating on ourselves in a way that keeps us frozen rather than moving forward in a healthy way.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and what about, you know, we also talk about blame. So it does seem that as you point out in your book, that couples will sometimes, the sex addict might blame the other partner for driving them towards whatever mm-hmm. sexually addictive behaviors they engaged in. And the partner who's not the sex addict would blame the sex addict for, you know, maybe ruining the marriage or the relationship.
Right.
What could you say about blame?
Well, I mean, isn't it something that I think that blame is something that comes up in every relationship, because there's this cycle of when we feel something that feels bad inside of ourselves, we want to get that feeling away from us as quickly as possible. It feels bad, I don't want it. Get it away from me. And one of the mechanisms that comes up really quickly for pretty much every one of us, one of the things we use is blame. That's your fault. That's not me. That's your fault. So that's just a mechanism of trying to get the bad feeling away. But the problem with the blame is that by taking that feeling and placing it out on someone else, we're not really taking responsibility for what's going on inside of us. So let me give you an example. So if George, for example, were to... And, you know, it's happened, you know, say the hostess at the restaurant comes over and kind of is flirty with him, and, you know, he turns and looks at me and says, boy, that hostess kind of, you know, I got a little hit from that boy, I got kind of attracted to her. So if I were to then blame him for me feeling jealous about that, then I'm not, that doesn't help the situation at all. So I might need to say, boy, that I'm having a reaction about that. Anymore, pretty much I don't, because I know that the fact that he's telling me means that he's with me 100%.
Well, neutralize the feeling, you know,
right.
the euphoric recall.
Right. So the blame is just one of those strategies that we use in our lives that just doesn't work. So the more couples can learn how to take responsibility and say, I'm feeling this. This is what I'm feeling. I'm feeling what I'm feeling. You know, good, bad, indifferent, that I'm feeling what I'm feeling. George is feeling what he's feeling. And then we can have compassion for what the other person is feeling. Like, oh, that must not feel very good. That must, you know, that must feel terrible. And in that way, with that kind of compassionate understanding, it helps the other person just move out of it instead of moving into a shame place, to, if necessary, to move into a place of guilt. And I wish there was an even better word than guilt, but move into a place of self-correcting. Maybe that's a better word, because
mm-hmm.
guilt maybe can sound
conscience,
a little loaded
perhaps.
As well. Yeah,
having a conscience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. A few years ago, I realized that just because Pahlgren gets angry with me, I don't have to be angry back.
Right.
And that sounds so fundamental, so stupid. I mean, But it works so well, you know, if I can stay present and just let her be angry for a moment.
Uh-huh. Because yes.
I mean,
absolutely.
It's so absurd.
Uh-huh. Wait.
And the same thing in reverse. Right.
Loving kindness, skillful means, truth, uh-huh. and vulnerability. That's what I tell my men to do with their wives.
Mm.
Treat their wife with loving kindness, and I drill that into them. I also tell them to be skillful with their communication. Skillful is a word that isn't used much anymore. And I teach them how to be skillful communicators, and then to be truthful, to be as truthful as you can be. And you don't have to be truthful and feel guilty and shamed about it. You can be, what I tell my guys to do is just to brag on, oh, my God, I just saw that hostess, and I got a little hit. God, I'm so glad I'm with you tonight. Oh, my God. What, that would have been a disaster if I was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be vulnerable, to make yourself vulnerable. That's not something we coach our young people to be. It's to be tough and strong and indomitable. But
now,
vulnerability is a wonderful thing.
George, it's an interesting concept. Actually, I think addiction oftentimes is a defense mechanism against vulnerability.
Sure.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about the difference between addictive sexual behavior and intimate sexual behavior.
Yeah, well, addictive sexual behavior is secretive, usually.
Uh-huh.
It keeps you away from intimacy.
Yeah.
And that's been my experience. I mean, I've had long. I classified myself as a sex fantasy and intrigue addict.
Uh-huh.
Intrigue is an interesting concept. It's flirting with intention. And I used to rain check women. I used to have what I call it a stable of rain checks. So I would have women that I would intrigue with. And I would say cute things to them, so they would be kind of hooked up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And they were there if I needed them, either for sex or for sex talk or for a little more than just flirting. So fantasy, I have people that are just fantasy addicts. They don't do anything, hardly anything sexual at all. They're just fantasy
addicts. There's actually a trend. I don't know if you've heard of the Japanese grass boys, grass-eating boys.
I haven't.
You have or you haven't?
I have not, no.
Yeah, I have not. So there's a trend in Japan of young metrosexual males who stay home and masturbate to porn and do not date at all. They don't date human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a subculture.
Well,
and I think it's kind of a scary trend in some ways because... I guess on one hand you could say, well, I guess you would be getting away from the spread of disease and unwanted pregnancy, so that could be a positive for society. But for the individual, it seems to me, living in a world that's not tactile and doesn't pose any emotional challenges or growth sounds...
Well, and that's totally keeping the individual... stuck in the realm of remaining focused on the sex act itself, on the orgasm itself, rather than the intimacy that brings in love, connection, compassion. And that's why we call having sex making love.
Yeah.
And the men who come to see George, with every one of them, what they really want is to be able to be connected with their partner. They don't want to be doing this thing over here that's taking them away. They just don't know how to get there. They don't know how to get from this compulsive sort of, I just want to go for the orgasm, to the place where I can connect with my partner in a beautiful way. And I think that's partly because of our culture and the way sex has been represented. And I think that what's going on the Internet is actually exacerbating that in a huge way.
Yeah, I also don't have anything against porn. I've actually produced some of years and years ago myself, alternative type
mm-hmm.
stuff. But mm-hmm. I think so much of what is out there right now is not only dehumanizing of the people who are in the pornos, but the people who interact mm-hmm. with the pornographic films
right.
seems to me become more one-dimensional in their own sexual interactions. And I have a lot of women who come into my office having sexual difficulty because they're trying to emulate what they see in the pornos.
Right. Oh, isn't that sad?
Well, yeah, they actually think that that's normal.
They think that's what guys want.
Well, and they think it's possible, but, you know,
right,
that's why
that's
it's
right.
called a movie.
Yeah.
That's not
why it's called a fantasy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not real.
I remember when I first met Paldrum, I talked to her about being real sexually, mm-hmm. and I spoke to her. I said, well, what do I do if I have an orgasm too soon? She says, well, so what? And I said, well, what happens if I can't? And she says, so what? And I said, what happens? I won't be cool. And she said, oh, no, that would be really cool if you are you. She said, I'm being involved with you. I'm not involved with some machine that creates great sex.
Yeah.
So she said, I'll ask for what I want, but she said, you just be still. You just try not to think about anything. Well, one of the things we do with our men is to try and teach them that one principle of tantric sex, which is to have a clear mind. And if you have a clear mind when you're having sex, both of you, you're out there in space somewhere. There's no more room for masturbation to porn.
Well, and that's the other thing too. You know, even if you're not masturbating to porn, even if you're not masturbating at all, there's ways in which you can separate yourself from your partner. And a lot of people fantasize about having sex with somebody else while they're having sex with this person.
Oh, yeah, that was my favorite thing to do. That was because I didn't want to create. That was because I didn't want to create incest. There was that incest would come up as soon as I thought that I was with someone I knew. I had a shelf life with each woman of about 2 weeks before I maternalized them. And that's one of the things that we have to talk to men about, because they maternalize their wives. It's a fairly normal thing that you do because you've been living with your mother, and then you get out of the house, and then you marry somebody or live with them, and then you see them in the pink hair rollers or whatever. You know, they smell the bad breath in the morning, and it becomes like mom, and that's when they start getting a wanderlust, and they think, I need some strange. And no, you don't need strange. You need to get intimate now. Now's the time to go to work.
Yeah. Well, and because we've been taught, so many of us have been taught, that sex is something bad, then there's either, you know, the whole Madonna and the whore thing goes on. So if there's someone that we love and we're close to, then we think that we can't have sex with them, because that's wrong. And so it's hard, because we haven't been trained to understand the possibility of the true, intimate, loving connection of taking that sexual energy and combining it with our love in a way that creates something that's with that partner, not with someone else, not with some fantasy, not with some porn star, but with the person that we're with. And if we can really be together using the sexual energy and the love energy and really creating love, that is you know, like nothing else you've ever known.
You actually, on page 191 of A Couple's Guide to Sexual Addiction, you talk about merging and independence. At times, each partner must leap into new and unknown territory of yielding to the other. Both surrendering control and taking full responsibility are required. It may seem like a paradox, but the two qualities work hand in hand. Intimacy is built through the capacity to maintain a sense of yourself, while at the same time being able to have compassion in an undefended way for your partner's needs and wants. The capacity to reveal the parts of yourself that feel the most ugly, weak, or vulnerable requires inner strength.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite beautiful, actually.
Right, and doesn't that really says it? Because what we're talking about here is the possibility of bearing ourselves in every possible way to someone else, and that does require a huge amount of inner strength and capacity, but also an amazing amount of let go of surrender. So as we come closer to our partner, and we, even in small everyday things, see that we can reveal ourselves and be safe, then the possibility of a sexual connection, of a deep, intimate sexual connection, just increases all that much, all that, it becomes even more possible. And the connectedness and the intimacy and the way the bodies can connect is remarkable.
You say,
bodies know how to make love.
Yeah, I don't think this culture really reflects love making. You say here,
no,
we all want
not.
To merge, yet we fear merging.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
A paradox.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly what we want. I mean, at the core of our being, there's this urge to meet ourselves, basically meet ourselves in the other, and yet that's incredibly fearsome. So the potential in doing that in an intimate relationship, that where a couple comes together and over time develops a capacity to bear themselves to each other, creates something that's, well, I mean, I said it before, but it is quite remarkable. That's the potential. That's the potential of intimacy, and that's the, and sex can play a part in that.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like you've really helped. What I like about your book is that you're taking people into what to do, not just what not to do. A lot of times when people are focusing on sex addiction, it seems like it's kind of this punitive, shaming exercise in don't. Doesn't really give people any signposts or guideposts to what would make for a happier, more functional blueprint for one's sex life.
Right, and how does that work? I mean, if you think of a child, if you tell them, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, then they're just kind of frozen.
Exactly.
So, you know, in the same way, if we can point ourselves in the direction of the potential mm-hmm. of something wonderful, then that's gonna call to us.
I think with the sex addicts that I have worked with,
uh-huh.
what has struck me about sex addiction is how you could be having a scintillating conversation. This person is bright and attentive, and looking into your eyes. There's a heart connection. It's amazing. And when sexual behavior starts to kick in, all of a sudden it's like the person that they're engaged with sexually becomes kind of an object. There's an objectification.
My wife used to call it hard energy. My second
hard
wife.
Energy.
Yeah. All of a sudden your eyes get a little hard, you know.
Yeah.
And your gut, and then your X-ray vision kicks in.
Yeah.
And the woman you're talking to, all of a sudden you can see through her clothing, which is
uh-huh.
a bunch of crap. And then you start the story. Then you start to talk. Then you start to act weird.
It's kind of ritualized, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Well, it is, and it's taking that, instead of allowing the sexual energy to connect with the energy of love and connection, it's just keeping it stuck. And
yeah.
so it's I mean, we all start there, you know, as we come into our sexualness, as we generally, when we move into puberty, we start with just, you know, like, whoa, what's this, you know, I've got this big sexual energy going on. Men and women alike, as we mature, we see the potential of bringing that into this connectedness and wrapping that all together in a way that helps us connect more deeply with our intimate partner rather
yeah.
than
you know,
sexualizing.
Young people tend to get crushes. I mean, they get crushes on their favorite, you know, celebrity. They've had their poster
right.
up on the
right.
wall.
Right. And those are sweet. Those are kind of beautiful. They're kind of
there
fun.
Is.
They're sort of innocent. You know?
Uh-huh. And then they get their heart broken.
Yeah. Well,
then they get their heart broken.
Now,
that's right. Didn't we all?
Yeah.
We're getting kids as young as 10 and 11 calling us now.
About sex addiction?
Yes.
Well, about seeing porn on the internet.
Yeah. Little kids that can't even they can't even put four or five, six sensible words together.
What are they
about?
What are they
saying? I saw the man do the pee-wee thing on the woman's face. You know what I'm saying? Oh my God! How old are you, son?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, what statistics are saying is that the average age that a child views porn on the internet now is 11. So, I mean, I don't even know what to think about that, because how can we as a culture teach our children about what sex really, what the potential is in sex, if they're getting this really distorted view of it?
Well, if
through internet,
you know,
porn.
Some of my clients that are sex addicts have actually prescribed more porn. There's a company by the name of Comstock Films, and they interview real couples who are married or living together and are in love with each other. They interview them, and then they film them having sex. And what I have found is that if you are a sex addict, this type of a film is disturbing.
Oh, yeah. Real love? Are you kidding?
Yeah, I had a client who masturbated about 5 to 6 times a day. He was immobilized by it.
Uh-huh.
And I asked him to watch one of these films, and he watched 10 minutes of it and started sobbing. He couldn't watch it.
Yeah, he wanted to see the money shot.
Yeah, well, they want, you know, again, addiction is about trying to separate yourself from emotions.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yes, that's exactly what, that's exactly the kind of intervention. It's almost a homeopathic intervention.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, if children were being exposed to loving representations, but like what you're talking about, you know, what they call Bukkake, where, you know,
right,
or ejaculating
right
into a woman's face, I personally think that it just represents the most depersonalized and degrading aspects of sex.
One of the services that we provide is we have a really fine young man that works for me. We advertise, well, there's a page on our website for parents to call, and the parents come in with the child when he reaches the age where he's starting to ask a lot of questions, and we have the talk right in the room. And if the parents are shy and upset and don't know what to say, then our guy knows what to say, and he tells the child all about it, and everybody walks out. The child walks out knowing that he can look at naked girls, or he can consider that there's this deeper part. And, you know, this young man has a gift for talking to young people so that they understand this. It's a miracle.
What do you do when a 10-year-old or 11-year-old calls you? You can't treat them without their parents' permission.
Right.
I'm just,
right.
What do you say?
Try and get a hold of the parents, and
yeah,
if they don't hang up.
Yeah.
And very gently and very thoughtfully talk to the parent so that they don't, you know, you never know who you're going to talk to. It could be a parent that's going to beat the kid with a baseball bat.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, what was it about, I guess about 3 months ago, I had a guy call from Midwest, and he said, he was crying, and he said, I'm going to have sex with my daughter this afternoon when she gets home from school. And I said, how old is she? And he said, she's 12. And I said, well, not on my watch, you're not. And he said, well, that's why I'm calling you. And I said, are you on a cell phone? So he said, yeah. And I had him look up the Child Protection Service phone number.
Right.
And I had him get in the car and stay on the cell phone until he got to the CPS office. It was about 40 minutes. And I had him put the woman on the phone, and I talked to the woman, said, this guy hadn't done anything, and I know you're probably short of funds, but he needs some help today. And I had him call me back. He didn't have the first nickel to put together, so... But I do, you know, I do talk to people. I mean, we're not in this just for money. We're in this to help people. We talk to anybody for 15 minutes. Anybody that calls, even the real crazy people that are out there. So we're always welcoming telephone calls, because we'd rather have people call us than do something insane.
Well, I'd love to have you guys back for another interview, by the way. This has been very,
oh, that'd be
very
wonderful.
Moving.
Love that.
Yeah, I really appreciate your thoughtfulness and your capacity to really understand this whole issue. Thank you.
Mm. Oh, well, Well, thank you for the work that you're doing.
And anyone that's listening, we really tried to make a good website, a very informative website, kind of a socially responsible website, where you can actually get some help. So if they go to compulsionsolutions.com, that's our website, they can, there are all kinds of interesting things to do. There's a test on there that talks about, that gives you an idea if you're sex addicted. And there's all kinds of things that you can look at to get some help. Plus, you can always call us.
You've got television clips from Cron TV and Anderson Cooper.
Right, Anderson Cooper.
Your initial free consultation, do you mind me giving that phone number over the air?
No, I'd be happy to have you do it.
Yeah, it's 925-932-0201. Once again, it's 925-932-0201. It's a free initial consultation.
Let me say that anything that you say will be held in strict confidence unless you're harming children or seniors.
Yeah.
Leave a message. Don't be bashful. I'll call back,
one of us will call back.
And we're nice people. We want to help.
We are nice people.
we really do want to help. Yeah. Yeah. We know.
I think what you're doing is fabulous. I'm glad that you're getting the publicity that this topic deserves, and I'm so grateful that your approach is one that's modeled away from shame and towards love. That's awesome.
That's right. There's quite enough shame in the world without adding to it.
Yes, there is.
Yes.
There is, and not nearly enough love, that's for sure. Well, thank you so much, Paul Drum and George Collins. I really enjoyed our hour, and I'm sorry it went by so fast.
Thank you. We've really enjoyed being with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank you. Have a nice evening.
Yeah. Blessings to both you and on your work as well.
Okay, thank you. Love to hear from you again.
You will.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?